I would, this is a part where we're going to be more interactive than we usually are. Usually we use the boot camp approach, which is to have as many speakers as possible until the point of collapse occurs. But what I'd like to do is call up the next panel, if I may, if Mr. Turner would be willing to come back to the table and perhaps move down one position, Bill Kittredge and President Parenza. And we'd like, Jim, do you have a nuclear device in that, or is, or is that, or just money from, and, but above all, what we'd, yeah, probably stimulus funds, exactly. But above all, what we'd like to do is to encourage an open dialogue that we could even include some of our friends from the Netherlands who might explain the pain of living in Amsterdam these days. Or, but I would like to start the discussion by, I think, by asking President Parenza if he might like to identify what he sees as a couple of overarching themes, and then Bill, and we'll encourage an interaction here. This will not be a series of talks.
Thank you, Chuck. And I think we saw indeed a lot of overlap in many of the presentations that still left that can be applied. If we can't duplicate Silicon Valley, nevertheless, some of the elements by which each of us are developing our own clusters have elements in common that, as a tool for moving a particular niche, a particular can be looked at. Our own summary has been about connectivity and relevance, building on particular strengths. I like to suggest that when you have a $50 billion industry in your state and you add 5% to that, that's always a much larger incremental economic benefit than when you create an entirely new industry that you hope will someday do something magical. It might, and yet again, it might not. That doesn't mean you neglect it, but being able to build on strengths, is, I think, is fundamental, and it also, I think, too much of from Christina a while ago, enables us to build on the fundamental strengths of the community, some of which are in small enterprises, some of which are, as we've been finding in Akron, essential to sustaining a community and creating additional vitality enhancement. To some of what we heard in this last panel, I did want to add one thing, if I may, to your question, Chuck. We're seeing across the country a number of foundations come together to create fund of funds. In Northeast Ohio, for example, some of the major foundations have joined with about 60 other smaller foundations to create an annual asset valued in excess of $30 million that is coming together around some of these issues of enhancing the vitality of a community, benchmarks, and ensuring that we don't segments of the community behind. So it's happening, and I would certainly encourage more foundations to look at that opportunity, bring together resources for the common good.
Thank you very much. I think that's, are there any comments from the audience? Comments or questions? Not speeches, but comments or questions? There's this pleading look for water or beer. Please, please, Josh.
Hi, I'm Josh Mandel from the World Bank. I came today primarily to look into how these ideas, I understand we're talking about American prosperity, but how a lot of these cluster ideas and fostering innovation would be relevant to the developing world. And I'm curious if anyone on the panel or anyone who has spoken today sees anything that would be particularly relevant on what we've learned, what works, what doesn't work, that might be appropriate when you're dealing with a place in sub-Saharan Africa or in Latin America that has hardly any infrastructure and or capacity, but is looking at innovation, research and development as a driver for economic growth. Just curious to see if anybody saw anything that might be particularly relevant on that.
At least from our experience, innovation is one of those slippery terms. We measure it in patents and that sort of thing. But Federal Express doesn't have any patents. packages shipped by airplanes or anything else. And so I think that what you're looking at and what we see is what does the local competitive advantage, if you will, what do they have intrinsic in that community or that area that can be developed, and how can that be extrapolated to create wealth coming in outside? I mean, that really, I can't offer a specific, but we have certainly found a very broad range of techniques and in a wide range of communities that didn't require a university else to drive this forward, that in fact were much more.
Josh, first of all, you have a namesake in Ohio. You're running for Congress. If you need see your name, it's there. Actually, what I'd like to suggest is that there are a lot of things happening around the world from which the United States vitally needs to learn from. Yes, I think we have a number of things that we can offer the developing world, but there's a lot of things happening in a number of countries, some of which you would consider developing countries, that are better integrated than national, state, or, if you wish, district, local levels into a comprehensive strategy. So I think it would go both ways. We have done, as we learned earlier today, a very poor job at integrating federal and state agendas.
Yeah, in fact, I'd like to emphasize that we have. Before I emphasize that, is
sorry.
Joe.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. This was just a follow-up on the World Bank question. I just wanted to point out that in exactly the same way that we're trying in Pittsburgh to create direct and deliberate bridges with the community, the same thing with the World Bank in communities around the world. If you've read Three Cups of Tea or any of these books about what works and what doesn't, if you have the right people on the ground who are trusted by the community, then when you fund things, they work. If you don't really know, if you stay at 50,000 feet, things don't work. So it's nice to have theories of change, but unless you really know the community and you're working directly with the community and the community is with you in your foundation, I should turn it around to positive. That's the way to make it work well.
Can I add to that? Because I think Chris is onto an important thing. And Josh, I say this with all respect, but I think that some would argue that the basic bank model has not been a great a success as it might be. The Eastern Asian countries have done very well by ignoring most of what the bank advised them to do, and some of the countries that have followed bank prescriptions have done less well. I don't want to be sweeping, but I think the model that you've used in some of the formerly Eastern European countries, where the bank plays more of a catalytic role, bringing best practice to bear, which is something the IDB is doing in Latin America. I think in your office on science and technology, and have a real opportunity to propagate best practice rather than get involved in in direct grants, of which 95% of which doesn't reach the user. So I think that's a one consideration. Another is ironically the we think the innovation award model developed in the, I feel sorry for people who've been using this model. The innovation award model that we talk about with SBIR, but also with TIP, and we use the term innovation award. It captures that it's not a particular program; it's a concept. And we think that has potentially major application to global health, and we're working with the Global Health Forum in Geneva. The innovation, as Aaron Mills pointed out, comes from small companies. We don't use a lot of small companies to address these areas, and we less to address a point that Chris was making implicitly. We don't use the entrepreneurial capabilities at the bottom of the pyramid. At the bottom of the pyramid within these countries. So there are, making small awards available to solve local problems could be a very fruitful way. Directed program organized out of Washington with fly-ins. So that may have been more than you wanted to hear, but it's, there's, play, if you want to
queue up at the mic.
I have a different perspective. I just wanted to bring up just I agree 100% with what you're saying from a policy perspective. And I'm just thinking another angle, if the question really is how do third world countries benefit from this knowledge economy sector, right? I think from an entrepreneurial perspective, if entrepreneurs here could take advantage, as you referred to, Charles, to the entrepreneurs on the ground there, whether it be in alternative energy, biofuels, bring them along with us, because they bring something to the table. Pharmaceuticals, it's incredible. So I would say reach out to them, entrepreneur to entrepreneur, and you could do them more good than any policy could do. Really, really.
Well, our small program here at the National Academies has had a direct impact on these type of awards in Finland, Sweden, Netherlands, and Taiwan, and Korea, and which is pretty good work, we think, for a couple guys in suits. So it's particularly in India, they have a very rich pharmaceutical tradition, which is both growing up and the more formal, which also has a lot of local remedies. Mashalkar, who runs the Center for Science and Industrial Research, or until recently ran it, and has made a marvelous transformation in that organization, points out that when we talk about clinical trials, they've run them for 200 years, some of these substances, so they have a fairly well record. There are other questions. Rich, exceptionally, you wanted to say.
It's not a question, it was for Josh.
Yes.
I've been doing some work in Ghana and Senegal over the last 5 years with the United Nations, and the project was to evaluate the creation of science parks in Dakar and Accra, and the World Bank was going to be a potential partner with IFC, and there was a small level of money available to do the planning. There actually was a little cluster analysis that was done in each of the countries. A Dutch firm was brought in to do a little cluster study. There was a local team that had to be identified to be the lead team in each country. But when the UN money ran out and it stopped, one of the things that they didn't do was have matching monies or a commitment locally, and there was no sustainability plan to keep the initiative going once you got the plans done. So the key, the other thing is, when you fly in experts all the time from all these countries and they come in, we hit the ground for a week and then you're gone, and then you're dependent on local people who don't have the expertise and have never done this on a long-term basis. You really need to have people on the ground living there, working on the projects on a full-time, long-term basis, rather than flying in consultants and departing quickly, because you will not have sustainability with the initiative. You won't be able to train the people that need to take the ownership and implement it themselves. So just throwing money at these things does not work, and it's got to be more than just planning grants if you really want to have something that's going to be sustainable, and it has to be a long-term initiative rather than a short-term grant.
Can I make just a quick question or comment?
Please, why don't you stay here?
Okay. Yeah, for those of you that wonder why I came up late, it's I can hear better from up here, so I thought I'd just sit up here now. One of the comments was made just a minute ago about bringing folks along. Let me just give a brief example. We run a thing called the Innovation Summit each year. We get 400 or 500 people together from the Pacific Northwest together. This year we had an opportunity with a group from Central Africa to come in. All they wanted to do was visit. And so for the cost of writing a letter that allowed them to get visas to come in, they visited us and spent some time. What's grown from that is that next year we're going to set aside a whole day next to the Innovation Summit for this conversation. And so I think we should not underestimate how little things like that might actually get something started and then lead to the initiatives like we're just describing.
Come to the microphones.
I'm sorry, Tony, you're one of you is. No, I'm sorry.
Dan Berglund from SSTI. Just a more focused technical question, both on operational specifics and also the politics. And Bill, I don't know if you'll feel comfortable with this. But on the $50 million national network of incubators, I've had a lot of discussions with people around the country who are concerned about that money being directed for more physical infrastructure for incubators rather than operating capital. So I'm wondering if thought has been given as to how that $50 million will be spent. And then the broader question, political question for the whole panel is, on this $100 million in the EDA budget that's part incubators, part cluster development, given that it's $100 million out of the existing pool of money, I'm curious as to what people think the political prospects are that that will get through Congress, given there's already a built-in constituency for the existing budget.
As the short answer to the question is, yeah, we've been thinking about this a lot. The question of how does this money get used and what does it mean? And one of the things I wanted to say to Chris is that in fact, at least in my shop, conceptually, we see these as integrated. When it gets out of my shop, I've got no control over it. Okay? Especially when it gets into the budget shop. But the $50 million, what are you going to do with that? It depends in part on which EDA program that money is appropriated to. If it is appropriated to the public works program, and of course our committees of authorization have titles of public works and infrastructure in the House and environment and public works in the Senate. You're seeing a theme here. So if it gets appropriated to that, then that will limit us to infrastructure investments. If, however, it gets appropriated to the Economic Adjustment Assistance Program, which is our most flexible program, then it could be used for infrastructure. It can be used for planning, for feasibility studies. It could fund revolving loan funds. So the short answer, I guess, is it really depends on where it's appropriated. Now, the other question is, how does it get, you know, divvied up among the regions and finally get spent? And that discussion's ongoing. With respect to the $100 million overall, again, I want to say that conceptually, at least within my shop, we're looking at this as part of an overall EDA program. And again, I get regularly spanked for saying this kind of stuff, but we're going to make every effort not to simply let the white roses get painted red. So that's about it.
Could I just I'd like to emphasize the point there about we actually do need infrastructure. So, but often that infrastructure can best be built with some of the feasibility studies. Our work suggests a very powerful catalytic impact of relatively small amounts of federal funding. That said, before we get really, really, really excited about the $100 million, unless my math is bad, that's $2 million a state. That should transform things quite a lot, I would think.
Well, Chuck, this is back to the pilot program idea, I think.
But very often we see this, by the way, we see this around the world, and that sometimes things with very big names don't have any critical mass behind them. And then other countries, China, Singapore, or China come to mind, have programs that are quite substantial. The lady in the middle.
It's a question to return to the international arena again. We're talking about the sustainability of funding. Do you have any comments about microfinance, which is seen a resurgence? If there are programs in commercial banks. Do you have any comments about the sustainability, the utility? Are these good programs from your perspective? It's an international focus question.
From my point of view, if they're designed correctly, I think they're absolutely amazing programs. And if you think of the bang for the buck or whatever currency, there's probably more good that's come out of some of those than out of almost any other kind of program. I think the real trick is to, as people were saying earlier, to understand the culture and get the appropriate checks and balances in. And with, for instance, with Muhammad Yunus and some of those early programs that I think the insight that the women are the traditional money managers, and to get a group of them who are accountable to each other so you have the check and balance, meant that you didn't have to have an infrastructure to oversee grants that were really too small to have people oversee. So I think that the real trick is how they're structured, and if you're at a sort of in a dollar a day economy and you suddenly make $2 a day, that's like us going from 100,000 to 200,000. It's an incredible transformation.
Could I just add on that when you combine the microloan programs with cell phones that are able to manage the funds, it's very enabling, and it's particularly helpful in enabling for women in more restrictive cultures who aren't allowed to public much. So that can be, and linked to Tim is, if you shift the finances of these, then you also are social position. So that's it's a good question, and it's an area that we would like to do some more work. I wanted to move on. Bill, did you want to a pressing theme other than your resistance to the increase in funding for innovation?
Well, I have members of my staff here, and they'll probably take me out and beat me if I go too far off the track. I think that the major theme that I got was government, innovate thyself, from talking about coordination among the government programs to talking about how do we actually work collaboratively with local innovators, talking about how, indeed, do we actually sustain these efforts over time as administrations change, et cetera. That was really a very powerful message to me. The other piece that I come away with, although it's something that I've believed for a long time, is that even though I was trained as a quantoid, as they're called, is that economic development measures have to go beyond the dollars and cents, if you will, or the jobs created and the dollars, and they have to look at, is this the place we want to live? Is the quality of life what we expect? And is it going to continue as we continue to innovate, improve people's lives?
If I could just, Jim, did you?
I have one thing I'd like to say. I'd say my biggest takeaway is probably one that may be surprising, but it's that all money is not created equal, and we talk about matching funds and so on as if it doesn't make a difference where the dollar comes from. But if you listen to what the foundation said, you think about Dr. Proenza, any money he gets from the state, if he can't pick a winner with that money, he's in trouble, unlike the federal government. So I think it might be worth looking not just at the total dollar for the project, but how you mix and match the dollars, because that I think probably is a way to give more policy flexibility.
Yeah, thank you. Let me take a bit of a different perspective. Being from one of the states, let me add a couple of things that perhaps build on what we heard. I think certainly right on topic here for today for everything. But two points. One of them is we saw a quote earlier about states being the laboratories. I guess I want to go back to that theme and say let's make that real. Sometimes we talk about it, but we haven't yet figured out quite how to make that. So let me build on the analogy, the mall analogy that was made this morning, right? If we liken federal programs, however many there are, to the anchor tenants, and so we'll make SBIR and we'll make TIP and we'll make the others the equivalent to Nordstrom and Macy's, we don't ask Nordstrom and Macy's to actually run the mall. We don't ask them to put the character together. We put people in the local communities to do that. And let me suggest, not without a little bit of caution in this, since I am part of one of these organizations, that the technology-based economic or innovation-based economic development organizations that we've talked about and other local organizations really are the places where that coordination can come together. And I think what that does is to help the federal programs remain true and accurate to what they need to provide, and it also allows a little bit of local color to work their way in. And I think if we can figure out how to make that, it's a relatively small investment that is required. What we'll see is something that looks a lot more like this one-stop shop, but it's a different depending on where you stop in each place, and it must be different. So let me suggest that that's at least one way to go about this. And I know that Dan Berglund certainly is around here and represents many of us. That conversation has begun. I'd like to suggest that we ought to intensify that a little bit. The second point that I'll make is that there are some other people and organizations that we haven't necessarily heard from today that we don't want to forget about. If you look in the state of Washington, and especially in the and even more broadly in the Pacific Northwest, innovation comes from places that we've heard about today, from universities, national laboratories. We have big universities, we have big national laboratories. But it also comes from places like nonprofit research institutions. And we heard about foundations today. We haven't heard much about the nonprofit research institutions. If you go down the list in the state of Washington and you look at the first five or six, by size, research institutions, only two of those are universities. One's a national laboratory and the rest of them are nonprofit and not insubstantial, $250 million a year kind of nonprofit research institutions. So I think that finding this way to take the notion that was made on early this morning, the clusters require three things: collaboration, workforce, and innovation. Let's take that first one to heart, the collaboration part, and figure out how we include everybody into this and find mechanisms for that to be happening. And that's just the nonprofit research institutions, I think, are just one of the people that we didn't necessarily hear from today, but I think would be very easy to include.
Go ahead. Yeah. To Lee's first point, I think we heard from Karen Mills the suggestion that we have well over 200 programs in the federal government deal with the broad arena of cluster development. And I think she had in mind something akin to the old agency cross-cut, some framework that allows all of the agencies to come together, pull together, and so doing, leverage each other's resources, hopefully, for better deployment of those resources as well as for better decisions. I think the other point I would make in that relationship is that in some parts of the country, I think we're not really focusing on productivity, and we're creating an increasingly larger and larger number of intermediary facilitating entities, often to the point of there being more of them than there are things to be facilitated. And I think that's a real danger that we need to explore how we really create something that works. We can do something of what we've been doing literally with one funded position. I suggested a lot of places that would markedly improve the productivity and reduce cost for greater effectiveness.
Yeah, I'd like to pick up on that, if I may, because I think cross-cutting, when people talk about one of the themes that troubled me here today was people acting as if we rationalized the federal government. Someone talked about changing the culture of the federal government at one point, and I wish them well, and I hope they're very young. I think this, what used to be called the size it, but in efforts to coordinate with White House muscle, and it has to be muscle within the government, can reveal both synergies and economies. I'd also like to echo, I think he was too polite to say it, but one of the troubles in both at the federal and the state level is a reluctance to reward excellence. You know, if you're very good enough, then we'll give money to Case. That's not in any way criticizing Case. I mean, just it's, you know, you don't always, unlike in the private sector, you don't always get a performance-based. Wait, I should withdraw that. That might not be the right way to right way to go. But let me offer you. I'm going to offer a quick summary here, and we'll break. But let me first turn to this question.
Thanks, Jeff. Something you all just said sort of sparked an interest in mine, which is about correlating where federal facilities are and where these clusters of innovation are. There's clearly a benefit from having Glenn Research Center, for example, in your area, Luis. And certainly where there are military bases where there's substantial research or acquisition or procurement going on, or where there's the national labs, independent of those federal facilities or long-established research universities, are there opportunities to develop these clusters, or are we seeing opportunities to develop these clusters in ways other than what, for example, Florida did in trying to jumpstart a biosciences cluster by buying essentially franchises of Scripps and Burnham and Torrey Pines and everybody else for $1 billion because they didn't have those facilities already in Florida?
I think there's certainly a lot of opportunities. Now, it varies as to the success. There are some of these laboratories that really fundamentally may be better closed, or if you can't close them, find some way to truly jumpstart them. You need an afterburner way to revive them, some way to keep them fresh, and that's often not happening. And those strategies of wish cloning and buying an entity are not without their own problems, but also not without merit. Some of that can be exceedingly helpful.
That there have been some good examples of that, House Fargo, North Dakota, right? I mean, again, what they did there is they recognized that they had an engineering school that was shipping people out. That was their competitive advantage. The two universities got together, EDA and the state, and the counties and the local governments all got together to form these university centers. You know, collaboration, overnight miracle. 5 years later, you see these growing clusters, very innovative. I was there in Fargo, I don't know, weeks ago, and sat down with the board of directors of this North Dakota State University Research Park, or Technology Park, I believe is what they call it, right adjacent to the campus. It's actually part of the campus, but the board of directors included the university president, two successful entrepreneurs, and some people from the community. I mean, the people that showed up. And they had completely integrated everybody from the congressional delegation, the state legislature, the governor, the county officials, the city officials, the nonprofits, and obviously the private sector, and have a very successful growing cluster there, not someplace that's a Silicon Valley, not someplace that is one of the traditional sort of places that you think of. So I think the answer to your question is yes, and I think that where it starts is looking at what the assets are, what the local competitive advantage might be, and how to exploit that.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So I was going to mention that Warsaw, Indiana, small little place, nearly 80% of all orthopedic hip and joint pieces actually come out of that. They've got 2,000 companies, small little companies that have developed in the area, specifically design, dealing with that. One thing I wanted to get back to, something that Chuck had mentioned, you know, about rewarding excellence. In a lot of the cluster analysis work we do, it's wonderful to reward excellence, and of course you build that in. But more importantly, it's important to reward behavior. That so much of what we find actually drives the outcomes is the behavior. The reason Silicon Valley and Boston and places like San Diego have fundamentally excelled has to do with organizational and cultural changes within their communities. The way people interacted, you talk about you have to create a culture of collaboration. Collaboration is just a word. You have to be able to align and incentivize the motivations of these various groups of stakeholders that come to the table for very different reasons. And you have to make sure that those are all aligned and then reward the behaviors appropriately. And when you do that, you can build this critical mass.
Did you want to come?
Yeah, I'd like to say one thing, and I'll be quick. Chuck said you really can't change the federal government. Those of us who are in the campaign and the transition team hope that that's not true. And I want to really commend Chuck for his foresight and amazing stick-to-itiveness to get this done quickly. But I want to say I think that this is a great topic also to think about revisiting after a period of time when we do have a head of EDA, we do have the rest of the people in place. And we've also had a chance to see whether Anish Chopra and Vivek, those people are actually able to bring IT to the federal government and change the way that it deals with its stakeholders. If in fact that happens, our discussion may be much different than it is right now.
Well, two things. Let me, is there anybody else on the panel who'd like? I'd like to make just a few last remarks, and then I think we'll break. First, I'd like to thank this group for, I think, bringing out a number of common themes which are important, particularly President Perenza's notes on the continuity and relevance and finding strength in our local communities. It's one of the things that I like about this country is that, and I mean this very profoundly, when things aren't working well in this country, we tend to think that it's our problem and our community's problem, and we have to do something about it. There are a number of other communities, and I won't mention Europe by name, where they think that it's their central government's problem and that somehow that should be immediately fixed. That said, our central government sometimes abandons our communities to their own fate. A couple of key themes here. One, that the states are laboratories. And this is one area that the National Academy of Sciences and our program on innovation, we want to look at what the states are doing and try and understand so that we can learn from each other, which is another theme that I think was very important. I also think, despite kidding some of our friends from abroad, it is very important that we learn from overseas. We need to learn from overseas because there's some very good models. We need to learn from overseas because what they're doing is shaping the world that we're living in. Only too often you have people, somehow they seem to be economists, arguing about what we should do in the world rather than what the rest of the world is doing. And I'm sort of in the school that paying attention to what people are, and governments are doing is more important. I'd like to mention, as part of that, learning from others, I think there's a broader theme of closer connections, looking at what the local organizations are doing and find how we can help them. A point I made earlier, small amounts of federal aid seem to have a disproportional impact within the state innovation ecosystems. And the foundations, I think, need to think hard about where they can put, perhaps at this time, even more significant funds. I was very pleased by the administrator talking about the importance of innovation awards. Our empirical analysis has shown that these awards, these SBIR grants, these TIPs, act as glue grants, bringing together more than we knew, by the way. This was some of what we've learned about SBIR, we have literally learned. We did not know that these companies were cooperating with universities as much as they are. If we had, we might not have set up the STTR program, which is designed to do that. Evaluation helps. And in fact, I'd like to emphasize that point. There's been a recurrent theme, an encouraging theme, of the importance of metrics. I was very pleased to hear the state program managers talk about measuring, and to me it's akin to taking pictures of your children as they grow. It's very hard to know where they were if you don't have snapshots, and those things help formulate policy over time. There's been a wealth of material here, but let me just draw again on Jim's theme of next steps. We would like to revisit these issues. We have an engagement from our colleagues in the White House that they would like to talk with us more, and that means we'd like to talk with you more. We're going to hold a meeting soon on early stage finance, what we need to do. We're going to be doing more work on renewable energies. In October, we'll be holding a conference on international programs. There are areas where we want to encourage more international cooperation. All the brains are not in this country by any means, and particularly some of the countries in the new members of the European Union, as well as the old, offer really major opportunities for very useful cooperation on science, technology, and innovation. I'd also just like to thank a few people. Jim Turner congratulated me on my foresight, but I fear I'm a little bit like Winston Churchill's description of the Americans, that I always do the right thing once I've tried all the other options. Jim made it clear to me that holding this conference within 6 weeks would be good, but since we couldn't do it within 6 weeks, we decided to do it within three. I'd also like to thank Ed Paisley for making so much of this possible. But in particular, I'd like to thank David Dirkside and McAllister Claybaugh in the back, and perhaps most of all, Adam, who has been the wheel that has turned so much of this conference. We're very much in their debt. They work very long hours. And some of them, one in particular, McAllister Claybaugh, some of you may think that he's always been here. Indeed, he always has. But he was in Berkeley for a number of years and has recently returned to join us, which we take as a compliment and an opportunity. We're very grateful to see him back. So thank you, Adam, for everything you've done. I think they deserve a round of applause.